I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal hoped on Facebook for the president's assassination. Representative Warren Lowe wished for vandals to be lynched, but responses to each plea for violence varied. Today, a tale of two social media posts with the ethics professors. We'll also discuss rebuilding after natural disasters. Harvey recovery costs are estimated at $150 million or more. Who should pay for that, despite the fact those areas will likely flood again? And some companies are implanting microchips in workers. Is this a bold step toward some dystopian sci-fi future? Stay tuned later for the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. So, one Missouri politician used social media to advocate for the assassination of an American president. A second Missouri politician used social media to call for the vandals of a Confederate memorial to be lynched. Do comments like that, advocating violence, merit removal from office? And a different topic, who should pay for all that rebuilding in Texas after Hurricane Harvey? Is that a federal responsibility, or is it up to the states and cities themselves? When the tough questions arise, we call in the ethics professors to help us navigate all this from an ethical point of view. The ethics professors are Wayne Vaught. He's the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. He's also a professor of philosophy, medicine, and bioethics, and he's one of my bosses on campus. Wayne, good to have you back.
Always good to be here, Steve.
Clancy Martin is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC and a professor of business ethics at the Block School of Management. Clancy, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Well, let's turn to the tale of two Missouri politicians and their social media comments here. State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal from the St. Louis area is a Democrat, and she called for the assassination of President Trump. Representative Warren Love, as a Republican, said that vandals of the Confederate Memorial should be hung from a tall tree with a long rope. Why? What would the great philosophers say? Do comments like that, Clancy, merit removal from office?
Well, there are two questions that we need to worry about. One is a question of professional ethics and what counts as appropriate speech given one's occupation.
Does the legislature have rules that govern speech like this?
Absolutely, that question. Also, the question of what's appropriate independent of what the rules are that are in place, because we all have implicit rules as well that come along with our particular professions. Then there is the separate question of anyone, particularly someone in the public eye, but anyone advocating violence publicly, particularly violence that has a charged narrative history. What I find to be particularly egregious is recommending lynchings, for example, when we're talking within the context of slavery. It's just grossly inappropriate.
I'm writing a column for the newspaper tomorrow on that very topic.
Truly not merely just inappropriate, but insensitive and misguided in all these different ways. Now, the question about whether or not they should be removed from office for a particular comment, it does seem to me that although we have high standards and should have high standards for people who are holding public office, we also have very high standards for free speech, and we have mechanisms for removing people from public office other than just case-by-case de facto deciding what speech we find appropriate and what speech we find inappropriate. So if a particular holder of an office has a history of speech that we find offensive, we as a public should make sure that at the appropriate time we no longer decide to put this person back into office. And whether it's even an appointed position, we can express that opinion as voters to the people who appoint such positions.
But those votes only come along every few years, and these comments are
in the cultural, you know, stratosphere here as we speak.
Well, that's true. But do we really want to be making our decisions about important matters that involve free speech in a hysterical way, in a knee-jerk way? Or do we want to say, look, somebody has said something that is grievously offensive here. No one should talk about assassinating the president of their own country, or for that matter, the president of any other country. I mean, assassination is just not something we should be endorsing.
And for the record, she said she hoped it happens.
Right. Yeah.
That's what the comment was.
This is a deeply misguided thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And hoping it happens is different than recommending it. But it is clearly, one wonders what her state of mind must have been when she made such a comment. It was really, really foolish. But I don't think that we want to get hysterical and start legislating in this kind of knee-jerk way matters of who gets to hold their public office on the basis of one misguided comment, even a comment as profoundly misguided as someone recommending lynchings. I just don't think it's appropriate for us to decide hysterically in a great hurry. Right now we're feeling very sensitive about free speech. We err on the side of moderation and caution.
Dean Wayne Vaught, your colleague here, is sort of hesitating about this notion of kicking out Maria Chappelle Nadal for hoping for the assassination of the president. What do you say?
I think they should both be gone and taken out of office. I think the legislators need to step up in this case. And so, you know, free speech in the United States is something that we deeply value, and I do as well. And there are protections that we have for it. Legislators are not in a different position in terms of their right to free speech. That's constitutionally guaranteed for everyone. There are zones, though, that even the Supreme Court has recognized of speech acts that are not protected speech. So yelling fire in a crowded theater
is an example
of speech that has not been protected. Her speech calling for, "I hope that the president gets assassinated," is a little different than saying "assassinate him now" and causing someone in an environment to actually act. Though it's sort of tangentially or slightly removed from that, because a person of that stature in a leadership position calling for someone could easily cause or motivate some person in the country to
assume she was encouraging the act to occur.
I mean, she was absolutely encouraging, at least for the brief moment that she posted it. And so she posted it and tried to retract it. But the internet is such, and social media is such, that that's not always easy to do. So, I agree with Clancy that we don't want to just sort of expand the scope of this. You know, the fear we have, and the reason that free speech is so valuable, is that when we start penalizing people for engaging in free speech acts, we stifle free speech, and people become afraid to speak up and say things. And, you know, I think even historically, the proponents of free speech acts have recognized certainly the value of protecting it. But when you get into this sphere of hate speech, of speech that's designed to cause harm or inflict harm or encouraging harm to another human being, you're not engaging in an act of free speech for the exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
It wasn't that the legislator was saying, "Hey, let's think a little bit about vandalizing memorials that you feel are depict or represent moral inequalities that exist in the world. How should we engage in that? How should we?" I mean, there are lots of things that could have been said that could have even been, you know, that could have crossed lines that people might have felt comfortable with, but we're clearly within, "I'm trying to promote ideologies. I'm trying to engage someone in a conversation. I'm trying to promote things." Saying that you're going to go out and lynch someone there's just no way that's not a racial comment and a racially derogatory comment. The Confederacy, the ties with slavery, the lynchings, the hangings, that's all there. And it's almost as if the person had in mind who the defacer of this monument was. So there you get into racial speech, hate speech, and conversations that I think are not protected. And then you have people in positions of power. Mm-hmm. And the legislature does have rules for how to remove people. And I think that this is an example of where the legislature could step up and say, you know, these are not only representing their own ideologies, they're representing us as leaders.
Representative Warren Love's comment again, Wayne, he said that vandals of a Confederate memorial should be hung from a tall tree with a long rope. Let's get our listeners involved here. Curious what you think. Should these lawmakers be removed from office or not? Are the comments equal in terms of in weight, in terms of how misguided they were or not? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Clancy, you know, do the two comments deserve equal denunciation? Are they equally offensive? I mean, after all, the calls for the senator to resign for calling for Trump's assassination were far more numerous, I think, than the calls for the state representative to resign for his call for a lynching. Politically, you can begin to see the wrestling that's going to be going on in the General Assembly as they come back for a veto session next week. They're going to be looking at this issue. Senator Chappelle Nadal is an African-American woman from St. Louis. Representative Love is a white man from Odessa. And, you know, some people say if you remove one, you got to remove the other. They're being linked together that way.
I think it is appropriate to link them together. I think it is also appropriate to recognize that this kind of vitriolic speech does take place in a context, our present political context, which has become extremely inflamed, particularly on these questions of what counts as protected speech, hate speech, dangerous mm-hmm. speech, this whole sticks and stones argument that we're having as a country right now. I think that both comments are profoundly inappropriate. I definitely think the lynching comment is worse for the reason that it is pulling up an entire past of hatred, a past that we can all agree upon is morally repugnant, a past that we are trying our best as a nation to put ourselves beyond, mm-hmm. to acknowledge collectively that our racist past was truly morally awful. So I do think that the lynching comment is worse, whatever that means. However, I also want to add that social media has created in our country right now, particularly on the question of free speech, a kind of mob mentality mm-hmm. that we are seeing break out all over the place. And it's, you know, right now it's happening in universities. Tenured professors say something on Facebook and they get in trouble. Adjunct professors say something on Facebook and they get fired. Mm-hmm. And this mob mentality is, I think we kind of have to take a principled stand on the question of free speech and our knee-jerk reactions and say, okay, yes, some people on social media are saying inappropriate things, and we need to bring it to their attention that this is inappropriate. We need to say we're not going to tolerate this kind of thing, but we don't need to make drastic decisions in a great hurry because we're getting all excited in a mobbish way about what's going on in social media.
So for you, social media is in a different category all by itself. Am I hearing you right?
I think what we are seeing right now in this country is that social media is creating a kind of mob mentality that we haven't seen before, and people piling on in really dangerous ways to suppress other people's speech without really thinking through or talking through the issue.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. Richard, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you, and thanks for the conversation. I think both of these comments were equally, you know, irresponsible and just really reprehensible. I don't know about removal from office, but I do think they should be held up by their colleagues as for censure because they're both public figures. And at one time, anyway, we expected more of our public figures. They work for the public. They're elected by the public. They're paid by the public. And they can stand in front of a microphone and be quoted and have their comments disseminated. So I think their colleagues should censor them. I don't think the comments are exactly equal because as bad as the lynching comment was, that's about somebody somewhere. The assassination comment is specific to a person, and the history that we have in this country, unfortunately, a president's being assassinated is very raw. But I do think you can't look at these issues, especially the issue with Trump, without seeing that his comments in public have fostered some of this mob mentality that the commentator was just mentioning. The comments is he's got a list as long as your arm as far as irresponsible comments, in some places calling for violence in his rallies, denigrating other people, maybe not to the point of saying somebody should be killed or seriously hurt, but
right.
created some of the very environment that is now being fostered back upon him by that comment by that legislator, even though she shouldn't have ever said anything like that.
Richard, I appreciate your comments. Thanks for calling. Teleprompter tweeted us this: has real Donald Trump not given this type of hate speech a platform? And I was going to point out to a comment he did make when he was a candidate for president. Donald Trump appeared to hint at the assassination of Hillary Clinton not once but twice. Last September, he spoke at a campaign rally and told supporters that his Democratic rival should have her bodyguards disarmed, and then he mused, let's see what happens to her. He said those things. They were talking about gun policy. And then, of course, he was elected president. Is there a double standard at work here, Dean Vaught?
Oh, I've never suggested that the president shouldn't be removed from office or shouldn't have been elected to office. I mean, his comments were equally reprehensible in the same way that we're discussing here. And I agree with the caller that platform has been created. What we're talking about, though, is the governance structure of the United States itself, and a call on an assassination of a U.S. president by a legislator within the context of the United States is still an inappropriate position to take. And it's not because that the president has been particularly enlightened in his comments. It's because of what it is saying about the office and about the rule of law and about the processes and the procedures that we need to hold sacred. And while Donald Trump, in my opinion, needs to be dealt with as well, and his I'm not justifying the comments that he's made and continues to make, but that doesn't call for the appropriateness of wishing for that person to be assassinated in that way. It calls – I mean, if we were to embrace that – as an ideology, it's a step away from anarchy. Mm-hmm. If a legislator was, I mean, this could go back to a Kantian argument of how could you universalize it that any legislator that you disagree with, you call for their assassination. Well, it's not something that we could, I think, readily universalize. And I think it does, in fact, would create anarchy and moral harm that we just simply would not want to accept. So I don't think there's a double standard. We just haven't asked about Donald Trump's comments.
Let's go to Les from Leavenworth. Les, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. This may be superfluous because I was talking to your moderator while you guys went into this subject. But basically, I was going to say that the comments about assassination and lynching are, to me, tantamount to a fatwa, which we definitely disapprove of. And I'd just like to hear that. And just the other thing is, you mentioned Trump's speech. I don't like to see other people seeing the language and the comments degraded because a leader has decided to take the low road. And it seems like more and more people are taking that low road. And that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Yeah, Les, thank you. What about this notion of fatwa and Clancy that Les just mentioned?
Well, it does. What one thing we do need to be worried about, and this is where I completely agree with Wayne and a couple of the callers, that there is a point. We are, well, as Aristotle said, words become habits and habits become action. And we are naive if we suppose that straight in a very simple way that sticks and stones can't break my bones, or sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. There is an appropriate time at which we say now this has become violent speech.
Mm-hmm.
It is it is as dangerous, perhaps more dangerous than certain kinds of actions are. And if we have leaders who are calling and clearly calling for violent action. It's true, we have to do more than merely censure those people. We have to say, well, look, we no longer think that these people are appropriate mm-hmm. for leadership roles. I think that's right. And I think it is appropriate, again, as Wayne points out, to be having this kind of debate in the halls of the legislature. Have we really crossed some kind of a line here?
Right.
Do we have leaders now who are effectively creating violence in the people that they lead? And it's a possibility. I mean, I went to a Trump rally when I was writing about Ted Cruz up in Iowa, and I left the rally with my wife because of the violence that was growing in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And we all know these comments that...
the violent mindset you're suggesting.
The violent mindset. Yeah. And then, mm-hmm. you know, there were, of course, more than one rally in which our president, before he was elected, I don't know if he's done it since he was elected, was sort of encouraging violence among the members of, you know, suggesting somebody should be beaten up or somebody should be physically thrown yeah. out, et cetera. So I think we are right to have our antennae tingling about these things and be saying, well, look, we need to take this stuff very seriously. On the other hand, I also think that we should be aware of the fact that we seem to be getting more and more hysterical in this country and be making our decisions with less and less deliberation simply on the basis of mass public opinion.
Yeah. We'll have to leave our conversation here on these comments from our lawmakers on the Missouri side on social media. You know, one person did point out that, hey, you have to wonder how effective either of these lawmakers can be going forward. If they're saying something like this, what else is churning through their mind? And do they have any clout, any mm-hmm. political cachet going forward here? Well, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll turn our conversation to natural disasters and who should pay for all that rebuilding in Texas after Hurricane Harvey. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with a juror who spoke of her anguish over sentencing a man to death, and we learned about the grim history of lynching in America and the need to memorialize its African-American victims. You can find those conversations online at kcur.org. and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, meet the man who was raised in Kansas City but went on to become a worldwide force in dance. That's teacher, director, and choreographer David Parsons. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're spending time with our ethics professors, two great profs from UMKC, Wayne Vaught and Clancy Martin. We're going to turn to a different topic here as we move along, natural disasters and who should pay for them. Texas Governor Abbott has estimated that damage caused by Hurricane Harvey will fall between $150 and $180 billion. My question is, should all U.S. taxpayers be made to pay for all of this or part of it or any of the costs of rebuilding here? Or should the cities and states themselves, individual states, figure out how to foot the bill? What's fair here, Wayne Vaught? What's ethical? How do you size it up?
Well, it's a good question. And part of it comes to, I think, the impact that the individual's actions have. What's the impact, the benefit to the community at large, not just the individual cities, but I mean, Houston is a major city in the United States, and its reach and impact, financial impact and otherwise, I think clearly reaches out way beyond the borders yeah. of the city and the state. So one question I think that those being asked to foot the bill would have to ask is, well, what is the financial impact? Am I a beneficiary of things that are going on in Houston, even though I may not actually realize them or feel their impact, as many of these major cities do that have reaches far beyond. So there's that, at least, question that has to be asked.
And so the size of the city matters to you.
Well, well,
if it's Timbuktu, Texas, do you care?
You know, I think that we should and do, but I was just saying, with the city, that's one of the questions that you would have to ask. Now you're sort of shifting this to, well, what do we do with these small rural areas, which exist all across the United States and are subject to all kinds of natural disasters, whether they be tornadoes here in the and Tornado Alley, whether they be earthquakes, whether they be floods, all cities and all areas are subject to this. And so, you know, we do pool these funds nationally to provide a level of protection, and taxpayer dollars go to fund that so that no matter where you live, there's kind of this equity. And in one way in which we talk about it in our class, and questions of distributive justice then come into play, John Rawls and Nozick would argue on different sides, I think, of this particular case. But one would be, if you don't know where you're going to live in the United States, or certainly don't even have the ability to be particularly mobile, are you then, because of that, subject to harms that might result from a natural disaster? And the people who live in Texas, some people say, well, why are you living so close to the coast, or why are you living in these areas that might be more prone, especially with climate change? And we've seen, you know, we've talked about the one that's now coming up the Florida coast, I think, is going to wreak some even greater havoc. So we're going to see a lot of challenges going on. You just don't simply know where you're going to be. And so we pool funds to provide some safety net, some level of protection for everyone in the country. And I think that we do that because we feel that it's just and fair that someone, just because of circumstance and happened to be in the middle of nowhere and a natural disaster occurred, are basically devastated.
So a federal response makes sense to you then?
I think it's a federal safety net, and it provides a way of spreading out the agony, as it were, and the financial impact across 300 million people, which means that the individual financial impact's lessened. If you try to say Houston's got to take care of this all itself, now you're talking a few million people trying to come up with what's an impossible amount of money.
You're bankrupting the city,
The city, the individuals, the farmers. You're hearing about the farms, the rice farmers, all of these people who have been devastated by this flooding, and there's going to be a huge financial impact. And so you would say, well, should they bear it all themselves? And I think clearly there's some financial bearing of the hardships that they're clearly going to be subject to. But should the federal government, should we as a society, when we're talking about the federal government, sort of step in and say, well, no, there should be some way of providing some level of protection for anyone wherever they might be.
Clancy Martin, we have a vote here for federal involvement when these big disasters befall an American city or an American region. Where do you come down?
Well, I would like to make the argument maybe even more strongly than Wayne did. It seems to me that we get into social contracts, like the social contract we have in our country. We exchange liberties for protections. One of the liberties that we give up is control over all of our own wealth. Some of our own wealth goes into a larger pool, and then we decide as an entire democracy how we're going to use that to better everyone in our society, everyone in our country, and members of our social contract. And to me, this is clearly a case where we as a nation pull together and help the people in Texas. What I hope comes out of situations like this is that people who do not feel as strongly about the importance of a social safety net for helping people who are in real trouble will recognize, oh, we had this big flood. The country came in and helped us. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should think the same way about educating the poor. Maybe we should think the same way about unwed mothers in our country who need social help. Maybe, you know, my wife is on Facebook fairly often. I won't go on it because I see what happens to professors who go on Facebook. But
you can't hold yourself back sometimes.
Yeah, you never
you
know.
You should stay off Facebook.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. But she's from Houston. And she has a bunch of friends down there who initially she was just worried about them and keeping track of them. And she says now their real libertarian Texas is starting to come out on Facebook, and they're comparing themselves with the people in New Orleans and saying, well, we don't even want this federal help. I'm happy to do it myself. And, you know, we're not going to. And I just find this to be very, very frustrating, you know, most of my education was in Texas. All of my family lives in Texas. I'm effectively a sort of Canadian Texan. And I am familiar.
Is that what that is? Yeah, is that what you are?
I'm familiar
Maybe
with
Maybe that
this.
Explains a lot. I don't know. Yeah.
Only scratches the surface.
I'm familiar with this mindset. And the fact of the matter is that the people in Houston are getting a whole lot of help. They're going to get a whole lot more help. And they deserve deserve the help and we should all want to help them.
Yeah.
And one just hopes that as they get this help, they will recognize, oh, good, yes, I could count on other Americans, and now I want other Americans to know that when they're in similar circumstances, whatever they happen to be, they can count on me too. You know, history always happens to somebody else until suddenly it happens to you.
Yeah. Let's see if our listeners agree with Wayne and Clancy that this is a federal responsibility to deal with this huge hurricane that has just hit Texas. 816-235-2888. Our number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jeffrey from Topeka. Jeffrey, good morning.
What I'd like to find out is why is it when some places definitely has a repeat situation, forest fires, landslides, mudslides, and it keeps happening, why do they keep paying out for people to rebuild their house in the same area?
You know, that's a great question. In fact, you're stealing the next question in my script here, Jeffrey, because, you know, you wonder about, you know, Houston might be prone to future hurricanes, future flooding. So what about that? Do you pay for that if it's going to happen again?
Well, that I think that is a good point, and it's
a great point.
It's an issue of sharing the responsibility. People who make bad decisions and then paying for them to continue to make those decisions over and over again. So when we recognize that there are areas, that there are floodplains, that there are particular places that are especially susceptible, and then people want to take the risk of building there, then I think you can make an argument that, well, there's a limited responsibility that the federal government has, and I have, because you've taken that risk yourself. Now, we also have to think about this in terms of health care and other types of decisions that people make. So, you know, the mountain climber who falls and injures themselves, they're taking risks, and we don't say, well, you know, you've done that to yourself. So McDonald's hamburgers.
Or a family that chooses not to buy health coverage.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so there is always in society some balancing of risk and risk management and responsibility for what people do. And yeah, you know, the people that like the beautiful scenery and want to build a house right on the beach – in an area that's prone to hurricanes, you got to kind of say, well, you know, fine, but you're kind of taking your own financial risk here. So I don't think there's anything wrong with the federal government or insurers saying, well, we're not going to cover these particular areas because one response is to bring in engineers and make sure the areas are safe and build up so that people can reasonably live. But and I think that we do designate certain areas, right, as you're not going to be able to build there. We're not going to protect on that
so
particular
land. So the federal government might say, we will help you this time, get your life back, but if it hits again, you're out of luck.
Well, at least to try to establish parameters on how much risk we're willing to accept and how much risk you should be willing to accept. And so Houston is, you know, it's a little bit inland. It's not like it's just sitting on the beach. And
right.
You've got a lot of buildings and you've got a lot of downtown area that were clearly impacted by this. So we can't just say, hey, let's pick up and move all these buildings a little bit further inland. So there's a limit, I think, to that responsibility. But I think that there are certain areas where the government could say, we're just not going to insure in this particular area because it's such a high risk.
Clancy Martin.
You want to be careful, though, to separate intelligent urban planning and public policy vis-a-vis urban planning from disaster relief. I mean, we do have mechanisms in place for saying where we should build, how we should build. We can do this in intelligent ways. Now, the conditions under which one is building may be relevant, but when you have a disaster, it's a separate question, and it's not the appropriate time to say, well, let's look and see, did you really choose sensibly when you built your house here? I mean, we need to get in there. We need to help people with the disastrous situation in which they find themselves, and then if after the fact we're having a conversation about sensible urban planning, of course we should be having that conversation.
Let's go back to some phone calls. And Dale from Kansas City, Kansas. Dale, welcome to the show. We're talking about ethical ways to respond to natural disasters like Hurricane Harvey. Good morning.
Good morning. I agree that the people in Texas or anywhere else need assistance when it comes to natural disasters. But I'm going to kind of tack on to what the prior gentleman just said. I think that it's a case of sometimes you need to say that, you know, we will give you money, but, and I'll give you a quick example, the town of Niobrara, Nebraska, they moved an entire town because it was in a really high-risk floodplain. And now you're not going to move all of Houston. I quite recognize that. But there are neighborhoods where you need to think twice about rebuilding it. That's my comment.
Yeah, Dale, thank you for the good call. You know, another factor here that some commentators have pointed to, which is this idea that a few years ago, a group of 20 Republican members of Congress, all from Texas, including both senators at the time, refused to vote for disaster aid following Hurricane Sandy, which hit the eastern seaboard of this country. Given that, should other members of Congress now vote down aid for Texas?
Well, one would like to hope that those senators who witnessed all this can point out the hypocrisy of their colleagues to their colleagues and point out the hypocrisy of their colleagues to anyone who will listen, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I think Ted Cruz is absolutely shameful display when it came to Hurricane Sandy and is engaged in some real hypocrisy now and should be held. We should hold his feet to the fire for it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the last hypocrisy we'll see out of Ted Cruz, I can assure you of that. But
how do you really feel, Clancy?
Yeah. But that doesn't mean the fact that those senators misbehaved that we should hold people in terrible, terrible trouble down in Houston responsible for the bad decisions of their senators. I mean, I hope they choose better the next time they're choosing senators, but they need the help right now.
You know, there also is this question, is the government obligated to continue the flood insurance program, which I understand is about $25 billion in debt? This idea that, you know, we habituate people to programs like this, they know they're going to get help from the government. Is there an obligation to continue programs like this in perpetuity? Because people count on it. They expect it.
Well, if it's been set up as a reasonable expectation and people have made decisions based on that, then I think that you do have certain obligations. But as the other callers have said, and I agree with Clancy, in terms of, you know, we can do urban planning, we have engineering, we have a lot of insight that can go into making decisions about rebuilding and certainly building a new development. And I think it's reasonable for insurers and the government insurers to say, you know, we have certain restrictions on what we're willing to do moving forward. Now, looking, you know, in hindsight, and I agree with Clancy on this, it's to strip it away, and people made decisions based on what they had expectations. They now invested their life incomes in a property, and now you say, well, you're on your own. I think that we do have some moral obligation to be responsive to commitments that have been made in the past and expectations in the past, but that doesn't mean we have to have those same moving forward.
Ronnie called to say this, if we're going to help one city, we should help all of them. Joplin, he points out, got assistance and recovered. The little town of Reading didn't. Also, we shouldn't pull money from projects like highways and bridges for disaster relief. In other words, don't take money from one pot, hurt one group. Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. What an interesting conversation it was, too. Wayne Vaught, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC, Clancy Martin, a professor in the Department of Philosophy, also at UMKC. Gentlemen, always appreciate it. Thanks for coming in.
Great
Thanks
to be
so
here.
Much
Thanks
for
so
having
much.
Us, Steve.
Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Girl, we got a good thing. You know where this is heading. Just a couple of us. Happy to be singing. Girl, we got a good thing. And I don't see this ending. You wanna fly, you wanna play, you wanna get away with me, you wanna play, celebrate. Well, look who's in the house. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some cool stuff to do on your weekend. And welcome back. How are you?
Ho-ho.
Always good to see you.
Hee-hee. Ha-ha.
Wearing your comic book t-shirt.
Yes,
the bright red one.
It's so strange for me to be seen out in the world with a comic book pastiche on, and we'll get to a comic.
That's what you're about.
I'm afraid so. We'll get to a comic character and a few items. But
let's talk about Weezer.
Let's kick off with Weezer. I love Weezer, whose top songs include Buddy Holly, Undone, the Sweater Song, and many others, including this one on their album, last year's album, their latest. It's called Girl, We Got a Good Thing. You know what's great about this is it sounds like, I mean, these guys are great because they take something that sounds emblematic of like a mid to late 60s pop song, and then they lay their own quirky, weird thing on top of it. I mean, nobody does that squiggly guitar
and it works.
Like Weezer. Boy, does it ever work.
Yeah.
Okay, they're part of the two-day Modern Music Festival, which will cover indie rock to hip-hop. Weezer's the indie rock part. They headline on Saturday night at Providence Medical Center Amphitheater in Bonner Springs. Now, I mentioned hip-hop just a few moments ago, and headlining the hip-hop side of things on Friday night at the Buzz Beach Ball. That's the overarching title of this music fest. Friday night out in Bonner Springs, you've got Snoop Dogg, right?
Snoop Dogg.
Now, Snoop Dogg is a rapper, and he likes marijuana.
Yes.
And lots of other things. But, you know, what's funny is most people probably, I would say most mainstream audience members might be more familiar with Snoop Dogg's movie and TV acting gigs, frankly, than his hits or misses. But he'll be delivering both when he headlines Friday night in Bonner Springs. How about a few other bands that we're going to be touching on at this show? Let's see, Friday, before Snoop Dogg, you get Foster the People, Spoon, the Toadies, Hippocampus, the Sluts. I guess that speaks for itself.
Where do these names come from?
From my, right here.
Yes.
Right here.
Yeah.
And then Saturday, before Weezer, you'll hear Run the Jewels, Gorgol Bordello, Bishop Briggs, Bob Moses, and, hey, let's hear it for Chicano Batman. I said we'd go get into the comic thing here. So have fun all weekend at Buzz Beach Ball.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak.
Boy, I like Ella. Always have.
Oh, boy, she's good.
First lady of song.
Oh, first, last, and you bet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what do we got here? Well, no Ella, but Ella in spirit, dancing cheek to cheek. It's Dance in the Park. It's the free annual outdoor dance class that then blends into a performance, which is all sponsored by the City in Motion Dance Theater. The free dance class gets started at 6:30 on Saturday at Roanoke Park. And then, as I suggested, there will be dancing on stage from a variety of local dance companies covering a multiplicity of genres. I mean, you could get ballet, modern, jazz, tap, hip-hop, breakdance, swing, tango, salsa. What's hooping?
And there will always be one couple out there who's just like head and shoulders above everybody else, tearing it up and fun to watch.
Yeah, is that you and the little lady?
No, it wouldn't be.
But I asked you, what's hooping? Is that dancing with hoops?
I don't know.
Maybe some aerial dance, maybe some break dance, and many different types of cultural dance. Check it out starting at 6:30 and learn to dance for free starting at Roanoke Park early 6:30 Saturday.
Be sure to see Brian's 7 stirring things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Let's turn to a couple of finger-style guitar virtuosos.
Yeah, well said. Okay, so we've got a couple of guys who are experts in finger-style guitar.
What does that mean?
Okay, that means no picks. Look, no Ma, picks. No picks.
Oh, just picking away.
Right,
eh?
I mean, with their fingers. And which has been going on forever, I guess, before picks were invented.
And they play on the frets, too, I'm told.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, there's two of them. Double bill, rare appearance by two great fingerstyle guitar people, 7 o'clock Saturday night at Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center. Okay, they are Antoine Dufour and Ethan Case. We're going to hear a little bit from both. They're similar but different. Let's check out a little bit from Antoine Dufour if we can.
That is just spectacular.
And that's
just amazing.
That's a guy and a guitar. Now, here's the other guy, a few years younger than Dufour. His name, once again, is Ethan Case. And he's actually playing a double neck guitar. He's more percussive, less traditionally melodic than Dufour. But let's listen to Case and spin his little tapestry of sound here.
Again, just incredible.
Incredible.
Just okay. Amazing.
So catch these two wonderful fingerstyle guitar virtuosos. 7 o'clock Saturday, Johnson County Arts and Heritage Center, 87th and Metcalf. The old King Louie, right? They turned it into the
That's
museum.
Right.
And you'll have a chance to mix and mingle with the artists after their performance.
Okay.
I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I'm strong to the finish, cause I eat me spinach. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
Let's talk spinach.
Yes. Let's talk Popeye, and we'll ease into the spinach. Now, was Popeye the Sailor Man the very first superhero?
Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, because he was introduced in the Sunday Funnies in Fimble Theater, that was the comic, in 1929. He was just some character that creator E.C. Segar introduced into an already popular comic.
You know these things.
I know that thing. And he didn't have a cape. He didn't have a mask.
He had muscles.
But he had muscles that got bigger when he ate spinach, a full 9 or 10 years before Superman was ever on the scene. So there's my little credit-giving session for Popeye. And why Popeye? Because he's the star of the Lenexa Spinach Festival. We're talking spinach-fueled family fun celebrating Lenexa, which was, as you may know, the spinach capital of the world during the 1930s. And everybody can have a taste of spinach salad and visit with the characters. 9 to 4 Saturday, SoCar Trails Park. Say that three times.
Yeah.
In Lenexa.
And finally today.
Finally.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the moment last. Just kicking down the cobblestones, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
What do we have here?
Hundreds, maybe more. Hundreds of colorful pictures will be created by professional, student, and amateur artists using only, well, let's see, three things. Their imaginations, chalk, and water. They blend the colors during the two-day Kansas City.
I bet that's cool.
2 days, Saturday, Sunday, Kansas City Chalk and Walk Festival happens at Crown Center. It's free to get in. The kids get free chalk. They can play and create for free.
That's Brian McTavish and your Weekend To-Do List. Thanks.
Hey, go
Appreciate
Chiefs
it,
tonight.
Brian.
Go Chiefs
Go
tonight.
Chiefs. Big game tonight.
They're going to do it.
Very big game.
They're going to do it.
Tomorrow, a powerhouse of modern dance who came from Kansas City. We talked with choreographer David Parsons. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up To Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Denny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.